struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Ah, yes. In the history of the United States, there's never, ever been a greater turnout for an election.
Oh, man.
Outstanding, America. Nicely done. This is incredible. Yes, it's nail-biting. It's so many things, but I think Biden is going to eke this out. The last look I had had Biden about 6 or 8 electoral votes away from clinching this. Now, of course, Trump is freaking out. He's tweeting, as I speak, stop the count. Stop the count. I mean, this is just crazy. The times we're living in. Hey, good Thursday morning. It's Mark Farrell live from New York. And a beautiful day and a very, very scary, exciting, emotional roller coaster of a week. Hope you're doing well. Hope you voted. And hope you're hanging in there. Some people are like glued to TV, glued to their updates on their phones. And how can you not be? Because it's just kind of exhilarating. I mean, this is the point that we've been working toward for the last 4 years, since 2016. Since 2016, my wife and I talk about this. We went on a cruise. We took her parents, my in-laws, on a cruise for a milestone birthday celebration. And it's the first and only cruise that I have and will ever go on. But that's a whole different point. And we're laying there in the cabin late at night going, can you believe that this goofball, this buffoon will be the leader of our free nation? Crazy. And it's kind of funny because we're watching the results come in on Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. I was up until almost 4 o'clock in the morning. I know I was one of those fools, but I couldn't get enough. I couldn't. All right, another half an hour, or maybe another 15 minutes. And I was just so glued to it. It was just, it was like crack, man. It was TV political crack. Anyway, so we were reflecting on the fact that, yeah, this is so crazy and reminiscent of 2016, some good ways and certainly some bad ways. But baby, have we come a long way. So I want to share with you about the show. We're going to be talking with Derek Black. He is a law professor at the University of South Carolina. He's a public education advocate, and he's an author. His new book is called Schoolhouse Burning, and it is amazing. Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. We'll speak with Derek in a few minutes and speak about the current state of education. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know. In the last 4 or 5 years, I just felt like it's taken a step back or two because, number one, it's one of the first budgets, believe it or not, to be slashed on a state level. And it's really, really scary. And now we're still in the COVID state. Yes, we're still in COVID. Hard to believe that remote learning, distant learning, synchronous learning, hybrid learning, however you want to term it. My kids are in school 4 days a week for 4 hours, which is nothing. It's a laughing stock. So I thought this would be a great, great opportunity to bring Derek on the show. He's so astute, so well-spoken, and such an expert in this area. And also a lawyer as well. So he, as a professor of law, but he's got great insight. But especially since, you know, all of us are dealing with craziness with education. Also want to share with you what I did yesterday. Actually, sorry, election day. I handed my mail-in vote on, let me see, last week. My wife and I actually went to the Board of Elections. We didn't use the Dropbox because we wanted to actually physically hand it to someone, which we did. And as I was walking up to the counter, I got really, really, as you probably have suspected, I get excited easily, especially for good causes and for bad causes because I like to change the tide. So I'm sitting there handing my ballot in. It's kind of interesting because it's not like you just hand the ballot and you go. You still have to show ID and you still have to fill out a form, almost like you were walking into the actual box or machine to vote. You have to fill out your signature has to be aligned. You have to fill out your address and what county and zone and all that stuff. So as I'm filling out this information, I said to the pleasant woman who was helping me out, hey, by chance, do you need a volunteer? She goes, yes, yes, we do for election day. I said, great, great. So I gave her my card. And later that day, I get a phone call. Hey, Mark, it's so-and-so. And we went to high school together. And she's the number two person at this Board of Elections building. She's like, we'd love to have you. We'd love to have you. I'm like, great, great. So on Tuesday morning, I got there at 5:45 a.m. And lucky for me, the Monmouth County Board of Elections building is very nearby my house. So I go there and I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be a very, very long day, exciting day, informative day, eye-opening day about, you know, just what the process is like. Yes, we all realize that, you know, ballots get opened and counted, but, you know, what is the actual process? And is it completely, completely laborious? Laborious? Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Painstakingly laborious. Anyway, I got there and I'm thinking also with my eyes, it could be really, really difficult. Hopefully they won't put me on something that's visually, visually demanding. And I said to my friend, and when we got there, we're like, hey, how you doing? She's like, I know I'm going nuts today. I'm like, what time did you get here? She's like, 3 a.m. I'm like, wow. So I'm like, what job can you give me? Just a reminder to you guys, I'm visually impaired. So for all intents and purposes, I don't bump into walls. I walk just fine. But reading material is really, really tough for me to see. So she's like, oh, no, that's okay. I'll take you over here. You know, I got something for you. So she walks me down this path, and it's a huge warehouse. I'd say the ceilings are probably 50, 70 feet tall. And the part of the warehouse I was in was probably, I don't know, 100 by 80. So it's a really gargantuan room and filled with, I'd say, 150 to 200 people. Those 6-foot banquet tables are everywhere. It's plexiglass up, just kind of as you see in the news. But, you know, obviously every facility has a different twist. Everyone is masked up. And so she brings me to this table and I meet this woman who actually is also a county employee, but she actually took the day off to work for the Board of Elections. So we introduce each other and we kid around a little bit, and she's starting to show me what to do. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, there's no way visually I'm going to be able to do this. And I didn't want to be like that person who's like, ah, oh, you know, is there, you know, something else I can do? I didn't want it to seem like I was not interested in doing this because it was a boring job. Was it boring? Beyond bored, boring to tears, but we had a really good time. So for the first 15, 20, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, I'm thinking there's no way I can get by more than like an hour or two, the max of doing this. So there's a process, you know, the envelope that you filled out, if you did fill one out, there's certainly procedures, there's a ballot inside an inside envelope. So there's certain things I had to do and there's checks and balances big time. So I was really, really kind of taken with the actual process, which was really neat. And I felt that it was pretty well secure. It's definitely labor intensive and a lot of redundancies, which was good. So I was doing work, checking my work and going to the next step. The next step, doing my work, checking it, going to the next step. Same thing. So there was about four different steps or four or five different steps that I had to complete before going on to the next step. And it was kind of funny because meanwhile, I'm thinking like, oh my God, how many millions of ballots are coming into this office? And Monmouth County in New Jersey is a fairly sizable county. It's not a gargantuan, it's not huge, but it's certainly not the smallest county by any stretch of the imagination. I'd say it's probably maybe on a 3/4 size in terms of the biggest counties in New Jersey. Anyway, it typically polls Republican Monmouth County. So now at a certain stage that I just explained, the ballots actually get open. So I have to open all the ballots, every envelope, the interior envelope, open the ballot, spread it out. So I get a stack and they're all in bundles. So I may have a stack of 50, I may have a stack of 150 or 250. So as I'm opening these ballots, obviously I can look at them. I can see them. I'm seeing Trump, 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 Biden, Trump, 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 Biden. And I knew not to get too alarmed because first of all, it's not my job. It's not my position to be there and to take stock or in my head go like, oh no. But internally I was freaking out. I was just like, wow, this is truly a red, red county. So I'm going on, I'm thinking like, okay, this is not even a small snapshot because this is just my pile of votes. But still, you know what's funny? And maybe you can relate to this, hopefully, because I imagine with every conversation you have or every piece of material that you read, whether it's online, social media, et cetera, when you read a Trump supporter's reason why they are supporting him and the Republicans, it kind of gets you upset, doesn't it? So every time, and this started at, again, 6 a.m., and I left it just about 6 p.m., so 12 hours later, every time I have to say with certainty that I saw that little circle filled in on the form for the ballot for Trump, it was kind of like, ugh, it's like a little stabbing. I mean, it got a little duller as the day went on, but still, I just was in denial and disbelief that so many people that can be supporting him. And now let's take a step back a bit. Now, when we think about all the different reasons why someone would or would not, let's think about the most paramount and most obvious one: COVID. Has he done a good job? No, completely lousy job. Race relations, horrible, horrible. He's just fanned the flames, as we've all seen, witnessed, and understood. But the upside to that, the silver lining, is that the turnout, we don't know. Actually, I have not read the turnout numbers because obviously they're still trickling in terms of ethnic appearance at the polls, but they must be huge. And I think that with COVID, with New Jersey being a state that you had to vote by ballot, there was no in-person voting, thanks to Governor Murphy. And at first it's kind of like, wow, is that really necessary? And I think it was a great thing because it gives people one less excuse not to be able to vote. I can't get a ride, or I have to pay to get there using a bus or city service or a private Uber service, Lyft. It just takes out that one level of difficulty or challenge. So I think we may be discovering something that may stick around for a while. Now, is the cost going to outweigh the benefits? I think that's going to determine on which party you ask. Now, I'm going back a few different steps here, but it's all obviously the nucleus is voting. And I read about a gentleman who said about his privacy was totally, totally obliterated because he's blind. And so I can totally relate because I have gone into many, many polling facilities where I would, because I wasn't with my current wife or girlfriend, or I didn't have anyone with me. Actually, you're not allowed to take anyone with you besides someone who's your child, I believe, into the actual curtain to cast your vote. So historically, I've actually had to have, and this is pretty funny, in that small little booth, a representative from the Republican and Democratic Party. So here's the three of us standing inside this booth. Again, not this year, but in 16, I did it. And it's kind of funny because they're like, okay, who do you want to vote for? What party? And I would tell them, and they would actually push the button for me. And so they're there to keep, obviously, all the checks and balances neutral and fair. But so this gentleman was saying his privacy has and was invaded. And I didn't care. I just want to make sure that my vote is casted properly for the person and party that I believe in. And I understand certainly how it's a private matter, especially since it's such a hot button nowadays. Oh my Lord. But it's interesting to be bringing up this subject because of, you know, persons with disabilities, how it can run the gamut and how a privacy is a major issue. Now, going back to my point before about how this could be something that could stick around, it could be standard policy. Maybe half the country will vote via ballots next presidential election in 24. God, that's such a far off concept, isn't it? But so was 2000. I think there may be some real grit to this, because I think the numbers are going to prove, and that's why Trump is tweeting right now, stop the count, because he apparently it's been predicted that the majority of people in states where it wasn't mandatory were going to be Democratic and African American and Latino that are going to vote by mail. So that's why it's crucial and critical for Trump to have those votes cease counting. But the voting is counting, and we're going on, and I'll try to give you an update as we go along here. If you're not listening live, if this is going to be something that you listen to on the site, obviously this will be old and moot point news. But it's kind of exciting to see all these different layers of the voting process happening. So going back to my day actually at the Board of Elections, I was really, really enthralled by all the different steps. So when I finished, I got trays and trays and trays of ballots and envelopes. So I'd say, it's hard to guess. I'd say maybe, 700 or 1,000 or 1,500, maybe 1,200 ballots per tray. So after I would have this tray completed, I'd kind of be like, hey, and there's a person who's kind of watching and helping answer any questions, any issues that arose. I called her the pit boss. I felt like I was in Atlantic City and she was like overseeing all the poker players. And I was the poker player or poker dealer. So I'd be like, hey, pit boss. And we established a good rapport and it was funny. And I was making a lot of people around me, including Debbie, the woman across from me, laugh. We had a good time. And so I've said to her, hey, I have this trade. And she goes, oh, I'll take it. I said, do you mind? I'll be gentleman, certainly as I always am. And I'll carry it for you. She's like, okay. I wanted to help her carry it. But more importantly, I wanted to see the next station. Where was this going? What was going to be done next? So we walked down this long, long corridor in this hugely open, vast factory space. And we get to the next station. And it appeared to me, and there were so many people going on and so much mayhem, controlled chaos, that I didn't want to ask too many questions right then there. But it seemed like the next station was actually scanning. Believe it or not, every signature is checked. Yes, I'm going to have to say that again. Every signature is checked. Mind-boggling how much time this takes. And pretty much I said to the woman, so if the signature is pretty close, is that an issue? She goes, no. It has to be vastly different. So I said, like, for example, if I sign for my mother, she goes, yeah, I mean, we would pick it up. Again, if it's vastly different, they all the votes that were coming in the last couple of weeks, they would call that person and say, Mary Smith, we would like you to contact the Board of Elections because we have a signature issue. And they would have an opportunity to come in and rectify that and sign it in person, et cetera. But there was actually two occasions where I opened the ballot envelope and there was no ballot inside. So the first thing I think of was like, oh my God, I mean, yeah, this could happen to anybody. But at the same time, I'm thinking, how could this happen? This is such a vital, vital election. And like what I did and my wife did when we voted via paper ballots, we put it on a table, our kitchen table, and cleared everything off just to make sure nothing would be damaging to the ballot. And we made sure we had everything with the right color pen, filled in the right boxes, because we didn't want any misactivity or anything to be spilt on it or incomplete ballot. So here I am going, oh my God, this envelope does not have a ballot. This is crazy. So sure enough, I said to my pit boss, hey, we got an issue over here. She's like, okay, here's what you have to do. You have to sign this. Every different step I had it like a sheet, outside sheet, that would pretty much state what I'm doing and what am I counting for. So I'd say there's 800 ballots. I write 800 ballots or envelopes, 800 envelopes. And then it would say how many ballots. And then I'd have to put for this one, 798, because we're missing two ballots. Staple it to the form and then sign it. So long story short, and this is pretty fascinating stuff, that later that day, someone in my family, wink, wink, works for the state. And this person oversees judges. And so she had to oversee things that were taking place that night, election night, online, to ensure the technical aspects of anybody who is challenging a vote or challenging the right to vote at the Board of Elections had the capability to do so. Usually when it's a non-COVID world that we live in, this is actually done in person in a courthouse. So there is a representative, a lawyer, and a board of board of election representative or representatives are there. So someone brought this matter up, I guess, we'll say Mary Smith realized, oh, whoa, I realized my ballot was not inside my envelope. So she contacts them. And then that's how this process went through. And next thing you know, they're doing a virtual court appearance. And they're saying now they also have a right to oppose this. Now, why would someone oppose one vote? Well, think about it now. It's some of the states and some of the counties are coming down to just a couple thousand ballots in difference. So it's fascinating to realize that it can And your one vote does matter because cumulatively, it's so, so very, very important. So I just found it fascinating, the whole process of the challenging and realizing someone's mistake. So anyway, going back to my work zone. So that's what I was doing. I was opening envelopes. I was separating them. I was not counting ballots because I'm not authorized or trained, but I was just preparing everything for the next stage where they would get counted. It was a fabulous, fabulous opportunity. My eyes were so darn tired. They were pretty much just like hanging out of their sockets. But it was a really, really gratifying experience to be able to walk out of there going like, wow, I was part of this cog in the wheel of this huge machine called freedom, the right to vote, our constitutional right to vote. And I thought that was really, really fascinating. Fascinating. And so you're going to find Derek Black fascinating as well. He's a law professor at the University of South Carolina. He's a public education advocate and author. He's going to be joining us next. His new book is called Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. My name is Mark Farrell. It's Thursday morning, a beautiful Thursday morning, and we'll be right back after this.
Talk with Mark now. Call 888-874-4888. Insight on the Progressive Radio Network.
Gives me great pleasure to welcome Derek W. Black to the show. He's written a new book, Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. He's a law professor at the University of South Carolina, public education advocate, and as I mentioned, author. Derek, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
It is unbelievable, the timing of your book. I mean, with COVID students, they're remotely learning, there's hybrid learning, there's in-school or any combination one can think of. This must keep you up at night.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, the book was signed, sealed, and delivered before COVID hit. And then I said, look, I can't go to press without adding some stuff. So I had to go back and add, you know, some discussion because ultimately the world got turned upside down, obviously, for our schools and for families.
Now, of course, I imagine you value education as a cornerstone of our nation, but it seems like, you know, with the stock market and obviously all the financial constraints nowadays, it seems like it's more of a commodity education right now.
Yeah, I think that's the real problem is that education, at least in the minds of a lot of representatives, has been lowered to the same as any other commodity that you might buy. You know, it's like, you know, you go to the store, you know, you shop for your favorite brand of whatever it is. Well, a lot of folks think you ought to just shop for your favorite brand of school. And the problem, I say, is that ultimately public education is that thing that we have to guarantee for all kids. We can't afford for it to not be in stock. We can't afford for some customers to get it and others others not. And so it's real danger that we begin to think about it as a commodity as opposed to a foundation of a democratic society.
And it's tricky right there. I mean, how do you strike a balance between COVID and the failing government, you know, revenues and education and not lose focus? Because, I mean, if we fail these kids right now, I mean, they're going to pay for it and we're going to pay for it down the road.
Yeah, I mean, so there's two parts of that. I mean, I think, you know, we come into the crisis with our public schools not having fully recovered from the last recession, to be quite honest. There were enormous cuts following the 08 recession, and about half the states still hadn't replaced them when COVID hit. And so kids faced a double dip hit in a lot of states. And, you know, facing maybe a triple dip if things get worse. But, you know, I think the fundamental point that I say over and over again is that when you look at our history, look at our state constitutions, education is in our state constitutions as priority number one, obligation number one. And so I think that we have to say before we do anything, we must make sure that our public schools have the resources they need to serve students. But instead of doing that, we have a track record, particularly over the last decade or so, of saying we'll give them what's left over.
Well, there comes the issue is that, yes, you just mentioned everything that's very, very accurate, but aren't they usually the school systems one of the first things that gets deducted and struck down, a slash and burn?
Yeah, so we're not following my advice at all. It is
how dare they?
Yeah, how dare they? Yeah. I mean, ultimately, if you look at state and local government, public education is the lion's share of the budget.
So sure, and it should be.
And it should be. And so that's also the first place that a lot of legislators go to look for cost savings. And what I argue in the book is that we really need to be sheltering public education during times like these, not just treating it the same as roads, bridges, and construction projects.
So what would you say to our legislators to make sure that they actually stay on this focus and realize that this should not be something where you should be slashing?
Well, I would say that if you look back in your own states, you know, almost all of them, 150 years, you will see that rising out of the Civil War, for instance, we understood that we had to make democracy stronger and that we had been failing our children for a good century, and that the path forward after the Civil War was to build public schools, to commit each and every available dollar we had to them. And so we have, fortunately, not a war, but we have our own sort of enormous crisis. And the pathway out of that crisis is to say, let's rebuild this democracy. Let's rebuild this economy on a safe school system. But again, on the democracy, let's rebuild this sort of confidence in government. Let's rebuild this civility towards one another. Let's rebuild a commitment to actual facts by teaching our kids, right? That's where we do it. And if we don't do it, we're going to continue divisiveness, and we're going to continue this fracturing of society that we've been seeing over the last decade.
Well, speak about the last decade, Derek. I mean, how have you seen, besides the financial aspect, which I guess we can't really remove that component because that obviously is critical to the implementation of everything. But in terms of someone who's very, very close and a professor on a collegiate level, but for public education, K through 12, how do you think it's been faring? Do you think that we're keeping teachers held accountable? Are they receiving the right materials? Are they in school? Even a basic question, are they in school for a proper amount of time?
You mean right now at this very moment?
Well, no, I mean prior to COVID.
Yeah, prior to COVID, I mean, what we saw was what the Time magazine put on its front cover, a war on public school teachers. So we ran a lot of highly qualified senior teachers off. They just said, look, I've had enough of this nonsense. The classrooms are growing. The expectations are unrealistic and not even valid by science. You're sort of toying with tenure. You're toying with benefits. I don't need this, right? Mm. And so we ran off the exact people we should have been trying to keep. And not only that, the young folks in college saw what was happening, and they said, look, you know, if I'm looking for a career, maybe education isn't the place. The schools of public education began to become empty, right? That in California, for instance, enrollment in the College of Education fell by like 60% there. So
that's huge.
That's huge. And those chickens came home to roost in 18 and 19 when there literally were not warm bodies to be hired in our public schools. So that's that side of it. And the other side of it is, you know, I think that we've had elected officials trying to turn regular everyday folks against public education, right? The way that they talk about it, the way they demonize teachers, the way they demonize the bureaucracy, the sort of language of quote-unquote government schools as though there's something wrong with the state providing public education. And now, of course, this language about freedom, right? So that what we want is education freedom, which reportedly will happen in the private system, and the government school is oppressing you. And it's quite shocking, the idea that our public schools are being talked about as though they are tools of oppression rather than the engines of opportunity that they have been for centuries.
It is sad. It's a sad state. And you think about it, it's just misinformation. It's rhetoric. I think it comes down to basic community interaction. Every parent needs to be involved to stand up, whether it's being a PTA member, being involved with the Board of Ed. Actually, I'm very, very close to throwing my hat into the ring. You'd be happy to hear, Derek, because you know what? I just can't sit aside and just watch some of the basic necessities of school, in my eyes, just really not coming to fruition as I think they should. But I think it really comes down to, you would think our politicians and our leaders, our superintendents, et cetera, across the nation would have this first and foremost in mind. And I'm sure a lot of them do. But, you know, we need to be the people who get up at the meetings and at the polls, like we do need to do today, to let people know how and what we want.
Yeah, you know, I would say part of what has happened is that the corruption of politics has come to public education. If you look at the broad span of history, which I talk about in my book extensively, public education has always been non-political, or at least bipartisan in some respect, that you have never had folks rise to the level of competing for the governor's office, or surely not for the presidency, who were against public education, right? Because there's this idea that it's part of something that we all share in and we're all committed to. And of course, politics has been very nasty for the last 20 years, but public education itself still stayed outside of it. I mean, look at the No Child Left Behind Act. Even if you don't like it, 90% of Congress voted for it. Look at the Every Student Succeeds Act during the Obama administration, when you couldn't get Congress to agree on the time of day. Well, 90% of Congress voted in favor of the Every Student Succeeds Act, right? So we have this, generally speaking, this bipartisan commitment, but that's begun to fracture, right? As I said, the sort of demonization of public education. Politics comes to it. Why does that matter? Because now ultimately we have people who are in public office who are not representing the interests of regular everyday folks. I mean, the public polling data in the South, for instance, shows there's only 3 to 4 points that separate Republican attitudes about public education from Democratic attitudes. I mean, that's amazing. And the attitude is that the schools are underfunded, the legislature needs to make them more equitable, and they support teachers. So we have an overwhelming majority of Americans that want to buy into the type of conversation that you're talking about, but yet the folks who are elected are moving in a different direction. And so, unfortunately, education is now on the ballot in a way that it hasn't been before, and we can't take it for granted.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have, of course, we can't avoid not speaking about our current climate. Education just seems like it's not even on the ticket.
Yeah, I mean, we had an op-ed with Jennifer Berkshire and Snyder the other day, where we were talking about how the media isn't paying attention. But if you look at what's motivating a lot of local communities, it really has been education. You look at these state level races, these governor's races, folks are very upset about public education. I had someone tweet at me yesterday that said that she voted against Donald Trump specifically because of Betsy DeVos. And I said, look, you're not alone. There's a lot of folks like that. So it's not getting the media attention necessarily in the way it should. But, you know, for folks that have got to send their kids to school every day and hope that there's enough staff and teachers and PPE there for their kids, I mean, this is about as close to home as it gets.
Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy is Derek Black's new book. He's a law professor at the University of South Carolina, public education advocate and author, of course. So in terms of our current climate, I don't know if you have any young kids or kids still in school, but how do you think and I know it's obviously a very intricate sort of fly on the seat of your pants in terms of the spring, but in terms of the fall, as a parent of two, I just don't think they're really executing education the way they could be and as efficiently and as effectively as they should be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that one thing that, even thinking about COVID itself, that that hasn't been talked about enough is the emotional aspect of it. That ultimately this is a scientific problem, but it's also a human problem, and that humans have to get comfortable with new conditions. And so, you know, it's easy for me to say, look, I'm comfortable. I'm teaching in the classroom. Just came from it now to talk with you, and it's been fine. But you know, for people who've been shut in, you know, the idea of going into a room with 30 other people is an emotional experience. And, you know, we've got to get there. You're right. I mean, distance learning isn't working.
No, at the same time, it's not cutting the mustard by any means.
It's not cutting the mustard. No. At the same time, you know, there are families and teachers, right, that are coming back at different paces. And I think, you know, I hate to say it, but you said fly by the seat of your pants. I think we have to let human emotions run their course until everyone is comfortable, because there's some children and families that aren't, and maybe for very good reasons that they're not. But we do have to get back to the school. And I will say, you know, when I returned this fall and taught in person, there were 30 kids in my room. I'm privileged enough that I have, you know, 80 seats, so they were spread out. But I said, wow, there's only 30 of you, it looks like 300. It literally felt like 300 people in the room, because I hadn't been around that. But after a week or so, I said, you know what? I feel privileged to be here. It is a privilege to be here to interact with my students every day. And again, I can't speak for everyone, but I do think that emotion will return to us, and everyone's going to come to it at a different rate. And let's just hope it's, sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. No, I concur with everything that you said. The thing that really disappoints me, I think just the curriculum and how they're executing it more precisely is something that I'm very disappointed in.
Well, I think in that first week or two of online learning, well, actually in the first 2 days, I said to my wife that if this doesn't change, the students will be done by the end of next week, because the amount of sort of screen time and lecture was mind numbing. And, I also said, and this goes the emotional and learning part, I said, look, I was better in September at teaching online than I was back in March. We all get better. And I said, they're going to figure it out. So, we have to give that room.
Absolutely, yep.
But the first 2 weeks were abysmal, in some respects. And that's not a critique of the... That's all new, yeah.
It's just reality.
That's reality. And so, but, I think what teachers have increasingly found is that, we give them some assignments and then give them some time to work on those assignments away from the computer or away from a lecture. So, mm-hmm. Part of this, and it goes, you mentioned superintendents earlier, this idea that we need to be able to verify that a child is looking at, that we need to verify they're working all day long. And the only way we can verify that is they're looking at the screen. Well, you know what? We've got to put some trust back to the kids. And yeah, some of them are going to goof off, but we're not doing any of our children a service by staring at them, 7 hours a day.
No, not at all. I mean, my son actually has learned to become very autonomous, which I love. But you know what's interesting? We got a voicemail, a robocall from the principal of the school district. And he said, there are too many zeros. I'm seeing too many zeros. I'm going to write an email. I was like, what does that say to you? Because they're not communicating and articulating exactly clear enough the assignments and when they're due. So there's, and I don't want to get too far off point here, but it's the reality of the world we live in. And more importantly, I wanted to get back to your early start. You were a litigator. You're doing issues right out of school, desegregation, diversity, school finance. So how did you swing more into the history and obviously the present situation of education?
Yeah, I mean, I was working about a year or two ago on an article, and I just said, look, I know these education constitutional clauses date back to the aftermath of the Civil War, but I just want to add like a paragraph or two in this article about the right of education. So I asked this historian, I said, can you just kind of tell me what to put in that paragraph? And he said, no, Derek, I can't, but you can figure it out for yourself. You know, classic sort of teacher type of response to me. And I said, I can't go digging through those archives. He said, no, hey, all this stuff, it's been digitized. It's on, it's in PDF on Google. And so I began to read the Constitutional Convention of 1868 in South Carolina, 3 years after.
Were you riveted?
I was absolutely blown away. I couldn't believe the words I was reading. I thought, well, maybe there's some anomaly here because South Carolina was majority African American. And I thought, okay, well, maybe that sort of explains a little bit of it, that they have a more aggressive view of citizenship and elevating mm-hmm. folks through education. But then I began to look across at all these other constitutional conventions in the South, and they were all saying the same thing, right? This really firm commitment to rebuilding society around public education. I'll give you just couple of examples of that. One, talk about poll taxes today. People think that's a dirty word. That's how we disenfranchise African Americans. Well, I can tell you that in 1868, the African American controlled Constitutional Convention, along with 40% of whites, said, we're going to institute a poll tax. And the reason for doing so is that we need a statewide tax. Land is worthless right now, and the only way we can ensure money for public education is a poll tax. We think people will pay for that. So that it actually comes in as a measure to create public education where it wasn't. And they were nice. They said, look, but if you can't afford to pay, you can vote anyway, right? And I was like, wow, the poll
pretty
tax
astute.
Came from that.
Yeah.
And then, I also was looking at issues of integration, which I thought was, sort of a Brown versus Board of Education idea. But sure enough, right, back in 1868, we have folks advocating for schools to be open to all, regardless of race. And so there's this phrase in all of the Southern constitutions that says, open to all. And the meaning of that phrase, when you read the debates, is so that both black and whites could go to any school that was a public school. And so from the get, and it was, hey, there was debates about it. There were folks in the South said, if you do that, whites aren't going to show up. And what they said was, well, we're not compromising on our ideas.
That's not that easy.
Yeah. Now, of course, we had Jim Crow that came after that. But the point being that, man, they were trying to build a radical new society, radical in a good way, I believe. That it's just mind-blowing. And so once I got into that story, it just kept, you know, peeling back the layers of the onion. There's just so much depth to what was going on in that period that I wanted to bring it to life for people who haven't heard about that story.
And Derek Black, before I let you go, give me your thoughts quickly on pre-K and how vital it is.
Yeah, I mean, there's a report during the last recession by some law enforcement officers. The name of it was, I'm the guy you pay later. And he was saying, look, you can't cut back on pre-K. You need to put more money in there. If you don't fund pre-K, I'm the guy you pay later. And if you pay now, like a dollar for pre-K, you'll save $4 later and other social costs.
Welfare,
so it's a no-brainer, you know, in terms of pre-K. The data's always been there. It has to be high quality, and I think that's the key. You know, it's not just daycare. It has to be high quality. But high quality pre-K pays itself back exponentially over
and,
the later
And do
years.
You think that charter schools are getting too much of a push than they deserve?
You know, charter schools started out as an experiment and now have become a way of being in a lot of communities. They're sucking money out of the public schools. And what we've increasingly found out over the last few years is an enormous amount of fraud and land deals. I mean, you've got people who are getting charters and then they're entering into contracts with their own businesses and paying exorbitant, you know, rental rates that you and I would never pay, paying prices for computers that you and I would never, you know, on and on and on, and they're just lining their own pockets. And, you know, if you did that type of activity in a public school, you would go to prison for it. The irony is the laws have been set up that it's actually completely legal when you do it in a charter school. The double dealing is enormous there, and you just can't do that in the public schools. You know, stuff has to be put out for public bid. Lots of people get to sort of weigh in to it. It's transparent. And there's ethical rules about, you know, board members entering into contracts with the district. But there's not in charter schools. And so that's something we've really got to get our hands on. And also the segregation issues as well.
Yeah, that's huge. Conceptually, it sounds good. It reads well. And I think I'm sure there's many places by you in South Carolina that execute it very well. But overall, yeah, there are a lot of issues and concerns, but I think that it's getting too much emphasis by politicians, though, how positive charter schools are.
Well, I mean, it's being held out as something that it really isn't. If you look at the data, about 20 or 30% of charters outperform their local public schools when you're comparing apples to apples. That means that
that's the goal anyway, right?
Well, the other 60 to 70% are either underperforming or doing just the same. And so there really isn't a basis to believe that they as an industry are better than public schools. They simply aren't. And if you really think about it, it doesn't make any sense. We're really saying we think those people can do more with less, which is to say we can pay teachers less and they'll be higher performing in a charter system. What you see is enormous turnover, you know, enormous dissatisfaction. And you see a lot of, you know, pushing out of children that are high cost children, you know, ELL
when you say
students.
Turnover, do you mean students or staff or both?
I mean both, right? You know, pushing out staff because, you know, the staff starts wanting raises or benefits and, like, we don't want to give them to you. So that's one side of it. But also not wanting to serve, you know, special education kids that are higher cost, ELL students who are higher cost, that ultimately what they want to do is cream off the lower cost kids so they can turn a bigger profit, right? And so our public schools are different than that. They have to take everyone. They don't get to pick and choose who shows up in school, who they serve or don't serve. So it's a really radically different model when you think about it that way.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Really, really good points. Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. This came out in September, Derek?
That's right. Came out the end of September.
And available everywhere?
Anywhere good books are sold, it's available.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you said good books. And you have a website, correct, Derek?
Yeah, it's DerekWBlack.com. And also I'm on Twitter, you know, every day sort of trying to relate this conversation to what's going on in our school. So I'm at DerekWBlack on Twitter.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your first book, Ending Zero Tolerance, which is another really, really compelling book, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. And that's printed by, I believe, NYU. Derek Black, thank you so much for your time. Please keep doing what you're doing, teaching America's future. And you must, very last quick question for you. How much do you love law?
You know, I love it. It's fun, you know, creating careers for folks. And so the only downside of it, I guess I would say, I spend a lot of time talking about, you know, business related stuff when my real passion is civil rights and education. And so, you know, wish I could teach more of that, but you know, everybody's got lots of careers to pursue. So I'm helping the students along.
Excellent for you. All the best to you.
Thank you.
All right, still a nail biter. 253 electoral votes to 214. Biden still on top. Man, oh, so very exciting. Mark Farrell, the show's insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Null comes straight up at noon today and each day at noon. He's got a very, very riveting show that I'm sure you're looking forward to, and certainly has put together a great, great radio facility. And his toothpaste is something I definitely want to give a whirl. I'm all about not having fluoride in the toothpaste. Well, something I want to share with you that had the nation sort of at their knees last year was the disappearance and murder of Stephanie Nicole Parrs. Now, Stephanie went missing on October 30th, 2019. And this really hits home because she actually lived in the same town as where I live right now. And I went to high school with her father, Ed, and Charlene, his wife and mother. And so Charlene went missing for, I believe it was 82 days. And I'd say probably 30, 60 days into it, they were certainly surmising that she probably would not be found alive. And it's just a tragic story. I mean, she was just I don't know her, didn't know her, but everything I've read and the people I've spoken with, it just says so many wonderful things about her. And it's just horrific on every level, because her boyfriend was a prime suspect from the get-go. And as you may have read and or heard, again, this is not just a New Jersey story. This made national and probably international headlines, that he was certainly being accused of being involved, was not really forthcoming at all, and actually was arrested on different charges for pornography, I believe, because they seized his computers and they found pornography or dissemination or something like that. So as the unfortunate Tory story unraveled, he was arrested for that crime, as I mentioned, and he hanged himself days later, and he left a note. And then unfortunately the note didn't say, "I'm sorry, I'm not myself, I'm mentally unstable, I did kill Stephanie Nicole Parrs." No, he did not. He didn't admit to any wrongdoing at all in that capacity. He apologized to his mother for making her upset and things of that nature. But I certainly know a lot about the mental health field. And certainly he probably was not in his current and right state of mind. But the thing is that it put all the families through just a horrific situation that they had to undergo. And fortunately, as dark and gloomy and just sad as it sounds, Stephanie was found a few miles away from the home in an area that had been searched before. But I guess certainly it is good that she was found, because it has some closure to the unknown and knowing that you can have a burial and some finality. So fast forward to 2 weeks ago. The family, Ed and Charlene, started a foundation called the Stephanie Nicole Parrs Foundation, and certainly about domestic abuse, education, prevention, information dissemination, trainings, et cetera, and they're doing invaluable work. So she was found in January, and they started this foundation only 2 months after. And with that, I'm so happy to say that they started organizations, two events that they created for fundraising, a golf outing, which happened early in October. And then they had a 5K run and walk, which took place a week later. So I was part of the golf outing in the capacity where I hosted the event at night. Mark Waddell, a good friend of mine, who's a high-ranking police officer in Freehold, he arranged and organized the golf outing, did a great job. And people come together. And it was just lovely, lovely to see. And then that coming Saturday, we had a event, which was a run walk, 5K run walk. They called it the Stephanie Nicole Paris Butterfly 5K Run Walk. And it was just tremendous. It was at a place called Lake Toponemus in Freehold, New Jersey. Beautiful setting. And the mayor of Freehold was very involved, Kevin Kane. And I was asked to host it, and it kind of took on a life of its own in terms of getting involved, because I certainly have done more than my fair share of races in my life, triathlons, marathons, et cetera. So I made some suggestions on making the run a little bit more expeditious and fluent. And so two of my friends who take my spin classes, remember spin? Oh my God, remember going to the gym? No, I don't. Back in March was the last time I taught. I called them up and said, hey, listen, the run is a little bit of a quirky route, and runners could easily take a missed turn. So is there any way you'd be interested in getting on two mountain bikes for each one of these guys and leading the pack and, you know, setting the pace, et cetera? So they did. And it was nice to see just how everybody just, with a phone call or an email said, yes, whatever you need, what can I do? I'll be there. And that's the way it should be. And I thought about, you know, the leading weeks coming up to it. I actually only got involved with it like maybe 2.5 weeks out. And I said to Ed, you know, I'd really like to get somebody to sing the national anthem. Somebody who obviously is gifted, but also has a social media following, because we really want to get the word out about Stephanie Nicole Paris Foundation. And certainly about domestic violence and the education and everything that's out there to stop this. And what's really kind of neat, if you go on snpfoundation.org, snpfoundation.org, which is the Stephanie Nicole Paris Foundation site, there's a button right away on the top and bottom of the screen that says, click here if you immediately want to exit the screen. So I suppose it's for if anyone's in a hostile situation or environment, or even at work, and you don't want anyone to be able to see exactly what you're reading about. Of course, it's going to be for a friend, hopefully. But that's why we're there, for friends in need. So it's a great organization. And going back to my initial thought about having a singer, get somebody who's really, really connected online so we could really draw an audience. So I reached out to a woman who I had never met prior to the actual event. Her name is Reagan Richard. She's part of a band called Williams Honor, out of New Jersey. It's like the biggest country duo out of New Jersey. And they're pretty, pretty big. I mean, big as in like they opened for Bon Jovi last year at MSG. So that's pretty big. So I reached out to her, sent her a message via Facebook. She wrote me back like that very, very quickly. She's like, Mark, absolutely love to be part of it. And she handed me off to her guy who's a publicist and handles arrangements of that caliber. And we made it happen. And she arrived, and she couldn't have been any sweeter. As a matter of fact, she had to park a little ways away, so I escorted her in on a mountain bike that I had borrowed because I wanted to lead her in close to the stage. So she had to, unfortunately, leave quickly after her performance. But it's one of those examples, again, of someone just saying, hey, what can I do? You name it, I'll be there. So for me, hosting this event, it certainly wanted to be positive, but I wanted to address the core of the reason why we're there and why we don't want to be there in the future. Meaning, yes, there's nothing we can do to bring Stephanie back, but we can honor her memory and legacy so no one else has to suffer in life. Life is tough enough, but you know, no one should have to suffer. So I want to make it positive without glossing over the real core of why we're there and the vital messaging. So that's what I did. I made it about community, about Stephanie and the community. I said to the audience, which was over 300. I would have liked to see 500 or 700, but for the first event of this caliber, magnitude, and really not having much time to prepare for it, I thought they did a great job attracting 300 people. So it was in Freehold. So I started off by saying a few vital things, including like Freehold. You know, you were there for the Stephanie Nicole Parris family when she was missing. And Freehold in Monmouth County, you were there when the unthinkable became reality. And Freehold in Monmouth County, you're here today to honor the life of Stephanie Nicole Parris. And that's kind of like how I couched it, because they really, really were vital to the community. I mean, the amount of people, hundreds of people who would go out on the searches, donate their time, their service, their vehicles, their equipment, food, port-a-johns, generators, you name it, countless, was just really, really heartwarming. Of course, it was heart-wrenching. But again, to see people come together. I started off by saying, hey, you know, what a great day, what a great crowd, what a great event. And I said something along the lines of like, you know, I love being on the radio as a rock and roll DJ. I love being a talk show host on the Progressive Radio Network. I love being a motivational speaker and touching people's lives. But on a day like this, being on the stage and being in front of each and every one of you, there's nothing more gratifying than being part of a community that hurts together and heals together. I mean, that's what a community is all about. I mean, the old expression, it takes a village, it certainly does. So the event was very, very successful. Not sure how much money they raised. I think the golf outing raised about $16,000. That's a lot of money for maybe 100 golfers, the most. And again, I made it light. Most of the golfers there were men, and I got them kidding about how they had to get, you know, drunk so I can open their wallets more. And then actually the event at the Freehold Toponymous Lake was great because they had a beer truck and they had a 50-50 and kid stuff and color runs. And so I thought it was very well done. You can check it out on Facebook. It's the Stephanie Nicole Parris Foundation. Like that page for anyone in your life who has experienced or you think has experienced domestic violence. A lot of vital information available. But more importantly, I'm just so glad that the father, Ed, and Charlene, the wife and mother, are putting their efforts. I mean, the hurt and pain that they're experiencing, I can't even begin to imagine. Can't even begin. But they're putting one foot forward after another. And that's what I said. The father spoke, Ed, and he started to walk off stage. I said, Ed, turn around. Just take a look at this crowd. Don't even say anything. Just soak it all in. This is what you've made. This is what you've created. And this is how you're honoring your daughter's life, Stephanie Nicole Parris. Well, my name is Mark Farrell. The saga continues. The election votes keep getting counted by the second as we speak. Let's have that closing music, gentlemen. And hopefully next week when we speak, we'll talk about how Joseph Biden, the former vice president, will soon be the president of the United States. My name is Mark Farrell. Gary Knowles next. Thanks to all the fine gentlemen, folks at PRN, and thanks to you for being part of the show. Have a great day.
Insight with Mark Farrell. Check out this and all Insight.